Hey everyone, I'm Jordan from New St. Andrews College. I'd like to invite you to join us for one of our upcoming prospective student weekends. We have one on March 2nd and 3rd, and another from April 13th to 16th. To learn more and to register your visit, check us out online at nsa.edu. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I've asked four seniors to come up, and they'll be starting off the conversation after the talk, and then opening up to questions to you guys. But our speaker for this afternoon is Mr. Luke Jankovic. Last term? I think it was last term. Last prospective student weekend, anyway. At a lunch, he gave a very brief talk to prospective students about how the NSA education helped him think about the particular work that he was doing, to think about it critically, and not just to sort of fit in with the prevailing work culture in that particular area of the industry that he's working in. And I asked him afterwards whether he could expand that a little bit for a disputatio, because I thought how it was a very, very helpful talk. And it's just encouraging to hear someone engage critically in the industry that they are part of. So he is Executive Vice President for Higher Education at EMSI. He is an elder at Christchurch. He's a graduate of New St. Andrews College. So I'd like to ask you to give a warm welcome to Mr. Luke Jankovic.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. Dr. Edwards, you were wrong. It was not high enough. There we go. Okay. I think I presented while I was a student a couple times. It's fun to be back. I know some of you, but I don't know a lot of you. And again, it's a pleasure. So thank you, Dr. Edwards, for the invitation. I should say that you, sir, are at a bit of a disadvantage compared to some of your esteemed colleagues who had me as a student. Unlike you, they would have known better than inviting me to speak. Before I get into the topic I've been asked to cover, I'll share a little bit more about me. I'm from Chicago. I grew up in Chicago. I moved to NSA in 2000 and moved to Moscow to come to NSA in 2002. I graduated in 2006. At that point, I'd been married a few years already and had two kids in tow. I've now been married to my beautiful wife, Rachel, for 15 years, seven wonderful kids. I have a privilege of serving on the Elder Board of Christchurch and also as a board member of New St. Andrews College, and it's one of the joys of my life to be able to contribute to the school. As you've heard, the topic I've been asked to speak about is how your learning here at NSA carries over into your vocational life. But before I start that, I thought I'd build a little ethos. I took a class on that at some point, I can't remember when, but as my wife put it, I want to unpack for you my Matryoshka doll of credibility on this particular topic. So, first, I am an alumni of New St. Andrews College. We've been over that. And second, not only am I returning to you from the world of work, but I come as a working professional in the field of technology. I'm not a teacher or a pastor, so not your average speaker. And not only do I come from this field of technology, but from what I call the dark and mysterious lands of big data and machine learning, a place that feels about as proximate to here as where the elves go when they leave Middle Earth. It's my Tolkien reference for the day. In other words, I work at EMSI, which is a local company many of your friends and family work for or you know about. So that's the second Matryoshka doll, second doll inside. So, and the third one is that in the past 3 weeks, just to give you guys a little example about what my life looks like, I've presented in New York City and San Francisco to impressive, credentialed, fancy pants companies about how to use big data, advanced data science, and software applications to more effectively connect people, education, and work. I'll talk more about what the heck that means later. But practically for the colleges I work with, that means helping them understand what jobs employers are hiring for, and the particular skills that their programs need to train for. The connection between education and work. So with that ethos or context set, the way I wanted to structure the talk is in three parts. The first section I wanted to discuss was just about the relationship between liberal arts and the labor market, not just work, but the labor market itself. The second is what I've learned out in the world having to work through what I call the MZ conundrum. I'm a New St. Andrews graduate who works at a company that uses labor market data to connect, to like help improve degrees so people can be more labor, like more employable. If that sounds contradictory to what maybe you guys have been taught, it kind of is. So I'm gonna flesh out for you how I've experienced that conundrum and the opportunity that exists there. And third, I have just some exhortations from the field. So let's start with the liberal arts at work. And I honestly, I hear a lot of times when people talk about NSA and the value of a liberal arts degree, we go into this sort of aping behavior of trying to defend the validity of the degree and its applicability at work, right? And what's the degree good for? Critical thinking, teaching, communication, all these skills that are really important to employers. But the another way to think about that, though, is that the first thing you need to know about how the liberal arts connects to work is that you guys are soft. You're soft. You have soft skills. Your abilities in learning, writing, communication, critical thinking, teaching others, teamwork and empathy, those are soft. You are creative and human, which makes sense because you do study the humanities, after all. And in fact, it's likely that you're genuinely interested in other human beings, which is a good thing. For a while, you soft ones were losing ground and underappreciated, and I'll get to some of this as I talk. People with hard skills were the most in demand. So what are hard skills? Those who had hard capabilities to wield technology, to eliminate waste, to drive efficiency, and to master with modern certainty this world. You know, those STEM people, science, technology, engineering, and math. So there's really just two kinds of people, in case you haven't been paying attention to the world. There's STEM people and liberal arts people. Clearly descriptive of the world we live in. Obviously, I'm being somewhat facetious in this description, but the reality is that this happened. So companies crooned about their need for hard skills. People started getting them and saying they had them. And now companies are realizing that the hard skills on their own aren't enough. And I would also argue that soft skills on their own aren't enough. So what do I mean when I say companies were crooning? And I'll give you a little bit of insight into EMSI if you don't know about it. One of the things that we do is aggregate data from job postings. So we look at employers' job advertisements over time and structure that data using algorithms so that we can understand more about employer demand and what they're signaling. There was a period 3 or 4 years ago where the majority of the signals were for technical skills. Employers continue to say there's a skills gap, we don't have enough hard technical skills in development, programming, engineering, math, et cetera. That lasted for a couple of years, and now there's this serious backlash that there's a profound gap, employers are stating, a profound gap in soft skills. And they're beginning to talk about the value of liberal arts at work. I'm gonna read this article from actually today, and this will make you guys, hopefully make you happy, because it made me happy. The title of this is Microsoft Believes That Lessons from a Liberal Arts Education Are Necessary for the Proper Development of Artificial Intelligence. Dated 1/26/2018. In 2011, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates told a panel of American governors that a liberal arts education would hold back college graduates in the modern economy. A few days later, Apple co-founder Steve Jobs declared, quote, that it's technology married with liberal arts, married with the humanities, that yields us the result that makes our hearts sing. 7 years later, Gates' company is siding with Jobs. Microsoft President Brad Smith and EVP of AI and Research Harry Shum wrote in their new book, The Future Computed, unquote, that one of the most important conclusions of Microsoft's most recent research into artificial intelligence is that lessons from liberal arts will be critical to unleashing the full potential of artificial intelligence. Smith and Schum wrote, at one level, AI will require that even more people specialize in digital skills and data science. But skilling up for an AI-powered world involves more than science, technology, engineering, and math. As computers behave more like humans, my emphasis, the social sciences and humanities will become even more important. Languages, art, history, economics, ethics, philosophy, psychology, and human development courses can teach critical, philosophical, and ethics-based skills that will be instrumental in the development and management of AI solutions. The two executives imagine a world in which our daily lives will be inextricably linked to artificial intelligence. For example, developers of driverless cars are already confronting ethical challenges, like how a car should rank safety priorities of passengers and pedestrians in unavoidable accidents. I'm just going to read that section again. For example, developers of driverless cars are already confronting ethical challenges, like how a car should rank safety priorities of passengers and pedestrians in unavoidable accidents. Ultimately, Smith and Schum argued, teams developing new uses for AI with human parity will need to include members with both engineering and liberal arts backgrounds, and both sides will need to know aspects of the other as well. If artificial intelligence is to reach its potential in serving humans, then every engineer will need to learn more about the liberal arts, and every liberal arts major will need to learn more about engineering, they wrote. So, what's the role of liberal arts from this perspective in helping engineers think about the ethical consequences of driverless cars? And it's a fair application, but at the same time, it, I think, presents this skewed world of hyper-engineering, hyper-technology versus soft skills versus the liberal arts and other considerations. I'm going to go to a different article here to give a different perspective. This one mentioned the conversation between Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, when Bill Gates proposed that liberal arts education should be cut. And this is an exploration or expansion of that. So I'm gonna read this to you. This is by Vivek Wadhwa. He's a thought leader on entrepreneurial activity at, I think, Stanford and has done some work for Harvard as well. He says, the title is Engineering versus Liberal Arts, who's right, Bill or Steve? When students ask what subjects they should major in to become a tech entrepreneur, I used to say engineering, math, and science, because an education in these fields is the prerequisite for innovation and because engineers make the best entrepreneurs. That was several years ago. I realized how much my views have changed when the New York Times asked me to write a piece for its Room for Debate forum this week. The paper wanted me to comment on the divergence of opinion between Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. In a speech before the National Governors Association on February 28th, Gates had argued that we need to spend our limited education budget on disciplines that produce the most jobs. He implied that we should reduce our investment in the liberal arts because liberal arts degrees don't correlate well with job creation. 3 days later, at the unveiling of the iPad 2, Steve Jobs said, "It's in Apple's DNA that technology alone is not enough. It's technology married with liberal arts, married with humanities, that yields us the result that makes our hearts sing. And nowhere is that more true than in these post-PC devices." This is what Vivek wrote for the Times. "It's commonly believed that engineers dominate Silicon Valley and that there's a correlation between the capacity for innovation and an education in mathematics and the sciences. Both assumptions are false. My research team at Duke and Harvard surveyed 652 US-born chief executive officers and heads of product engineering at 502 technology companies. We found that they tended to be highly educated. 92% held bachelor's degrees, 47% held higher degrees, but only 37% held degrees in engineering or computer technology, and just 2% in math. The rest have degrees in fields as diverse as business, accounting, finance, health, the arts, and humanities. Getting a degree made a big difference in the sales and employment of the company that a founder started, but the field that the degree was in and the school that it was obtained from were not a significant factor. Over the past year, I've interviewed the founders of more than 200 Silicon Valley startups. The most common traits I've observed are a passion to change the world and the confidence to defy the odds and succeed. And this is the part that I really want you guys to hear. It is the same in business. In the two companies I founded, I was involved in hiring more than 1,000 workers over the years. I never observed a correlation between the school of graduation or field of study on one hand and success in the workplace on the other. What makes people successful are their motivation, their drive, and ability to learn from mistakes and how hard they work. What makes people successful is not their degree or the school they went to. It's who they are. Let me figure out where I am here on my notes. So what's the relationship between the liberal arts and work? My sort of assertion here is that it only matters insofar as your education has shaped you into the kind of person who's valuable to your employer and to your community. I want us to get out of the game of arguing the value of the liberal arts as opposed to other degrees. As a board member, I can assure you that our goal at NSA is to produce a certain kind of person, not to be curators and guardians of a particular means of education. While we're confident that our pedagogy is the most effective way to produce leaders who shape culture, it's a means, not an end in itself. In other words, to echo the words of the article I read, it's not what degree you have, it's who you are. That's what we care about producing here at NSA, and that's what we need you to take responsibility for as well. If you ever start feeling insecure about your degree, please stop. Stop. Don't get into conversations or arguments with others about the value of a liberal arts degree in the workforce. I think it's a trap, because you end up arguing about things that you're... Here's why it's a trap. I've already stated it. Who you are is the most important thing, not necessarily the degree you have. So that, from my perspective, is how the liberal arts connects to work. It's how really every degree connects to work. And as an employer, someone who hires people, someone who interviews, the most important thing I look for is not necessarily what experience or training someone has. I want to get an understanding of who they are and what they've done. Who are you? What have you made in the world? And do you take responsibility for yourself? Let me talk a little bit then, if that's my perspective, on how the liberal arts connects to work and effectively how all degrees connect to work, a little bit about my experience at MZ and what I call the MZ conundrum, which is this reality that I went to an institution and I believe that the education you receive and how it shapes you is far, far more important than the actual sort of skills and keywords associated with that degree, with that training. But then I now work at a company where most of what we do is help people think about how to make degrees more relevant for employers. We've moved, we're effectively a company that provides data for training and not for education. And how do I deal with that kind of conundrum? You might have, I don't know if any of you guys have noticed it, there are a lot of NSA kids at MZ, and it would seem like we might have an existential crisis about this, right? Hey, we literally went to a school where the brochure says that your degree doesn't matter about where it leads to work, and now we work at a company that says, we're gonna help you make sure your degrees lead to work. Like, it's just kind of a contradiction, and I've often asked, actually, the Lord himself, what is going on here? Why are we doing this? And in days at work where we're dealing with people stuck in a really upside down paradigm about the nature of who people are and the nature of skills and the nature of work, like, what's the point of all this, Lord? And I've come to the conclusion over time that the best people to bring data are people who are skeptical of the project in and of itself. A little bit of biographical background about what my job is right now, and then I'm going to tell a story that it's the same story I told at the prospective student meeting about challenging some worldview assumptions out there in the field. One of the things that we struggle with at MZ all the time is helping understand how degrees lead to careers. For most people, the sounds like a job major is pretty easy, right? Like what's the practical utility of an engineering degree? Well, you can get an engineering job. What's the practical utility of a liberal arts degree? Well, you can become a liberal artist. Not quite. There's a huge amount of really boring and unimaginative thinking out there in the world in education today. So students, more than ever, because of the higher cost of tuition, are trying to figure out, they're trying to make sure that they don't go into debt, parents and students. So the value proposition has become really, really pragmatic. I know Dr. Merkel, Ben, faces this when he goes out and talks to parents. Great, sounds cool, what job is my kid gonna get? Well, why is that important? Well, it's important because you're investing a lot of money into this education, right? That's the general paradigm for many students and parents. The value of education, the value proposition of education, I was talking about this in San Francisco Wednesday, has become a job. The value proposition of college has become a job, right? That's sort of the current paradigm. And we deal with that all the time at MZ. And one of the challenges that we're facing, and honestly I'm working hard on with my colleagues, is how do we help people think more imaginatively and more accurately about how people connect to work. So we have this crazy data set. It's 108 million profiles of people working in the US. It starts as 600 million social professional profiles that we singulate, which is a cool word for deduplicate, which is a cool word for singulate, down. We go out and we scrape the internet, LinkedIn, Career Builder, all these different sites where people talk about themselves at work. This is big data, like big, big data. And we take those profiles and we try and find individuals that we can create a unique profile for across multiple sources. So I'm Luke, I have a Career Builder resume, a LinkedIn profile. In MZ data, an MZ profile has information from both of those sources. So we're able to extract the degree an individual, the major of an individual, and effectively their career path. So for the 100 million profiles of people working in the US that we have 500 million job transition observations, an average of 5 per individual. So we have the actual worn paths between education into the labor market, and then once in the labor market, into other fields. Does that make sense? So when I found the presence, the building of that data set and the success of that data set for me was really inspiring at work, because one of the things I want to do is subvert the current paradigm, which doesn't have enough data with enough nuance to highlight how, well, I'll use a particular finding that we found in Pennsylvania, that you're as likely to become an IT worker out of a humanities degree as out of a STEM degree. You're as likely to become an IT worker in Pennsylvania if you graduate with a humanities degree as if you were also to graduate from an IT degree. Something you guys probably don't know is not only are schools kind of unimaginative and bad at seeing these relationships, but so are employers. Well, another piece of work we do at MZ is aggregate job posting data. I've mentioned that before, but we aggregate all these signals from employers about what they need. So employers mostly want to hire online, and they want, because it's less personal, that's something we can talk about, the depersonalization of hiring. It's one of the worst things that's happened. When we look at those signals, we see a lot of really, employers are really bad at signaling in the market what they really need, and job seekers are really bad at signaling what they are. And then there are lots of companies and other agencies who come in and try and read those signals and drive decisions from them about policy. One of the things we've found with employers, as an example, is that they really don't know how they source their current talent. So at MZ, if you go in the engineering room at MZ, you see a lot of developers. You might think, oh, those are like computer people, right? Just computer people. And if you ask them to raise their hand and say, how many of you have a computer science degree? Like, maybe 40% will raise their hand. How many of you have a humanities degree? Another 30% will raise their hand. That kind of distribution of paths into a field is real everywhere you go. But what we want to say today is that, well, if you want to get a good development job, you got to be a computer science person. It's just not true. It's just not true. And you may have heard of the skills gap. Have you guys heard of the skills gap? The skills gap. We're going to lose to China and India because we're not producing enough STEM skills. There's a huge skills gap in America. This is sort of the mantra. There aren't enough skilled, hard-skilled technology workers. Employers can't find them. The reason employers can't find them is they're being lazy. They're just asking for them and not getting them, but they don't know enough about how they source them today. I mentioned sourcing. So if we actually provide companies data about where computer engineering grads are coming from, one of the things they don't see, though, they're like, well, I've got to hire computer engineers. I can't find them, software developer, web developer, whatever it may be. Where are their grads? What schools have grads? So we give them data about that. We have data about what schools have grads in those fields. And they go and they interview all those folks and they don't hire enough. One of the exciting things about looking at the connection between degrees and work in this more rich way is we can say with empirical data, you know what else you should do? You probably haven't visited the sociology department to look for people, but you should, because you're sourcing 10% of your current workforce in IT from that area. Companies, schools, and students and parents, I find to be remarkably unimaginative about how the world actually works and how people move between education and work. The really upside down part of it, too, is most people's experience is different than what they're trying to project out into the world. So for example, I'm a VP of effectively a vice president of product. So my job is to use data, to use data to solve and answer customer problems. That means building data sets, building models, and building applications that make it really easy for our customers to answer their questions. I have a liberal arts degree. Commonly in my situation, what someone will do is not think that the experience that I had is normal, but expect that everyone else had sort of this linear path. I went to college and I knew I wanted to be a product manager, so I took a degree in product management and then I got a product management job. It's like in all of these rooms across America, I'll ask this question. So how many of you guys actually trained for the field you're in? And like half of them will raise their hands. It's like, so why are you so focused on forcing everybody to train for a field? And that usually, people usually go, oh yeah, it's okay. So the MZ conundrum, how am I dealing with it? We're really working hard to use these new data that we have to map the relationship between education and work at a level that's, like I said, more imaginative and more reflective of the actual world. Because we think if we do that, we'll give individuals, as they think about a major and a career, and companies as well, the opportunity to see what's really been happening and hopefully eliminate some of this linear sort of oversimplified thinking that is going on today about STEM and the like. Does that make sense? And I have often asked the Lord, why do I work at this company? So let me tell you a story about life in the field. So I was in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago presenting. We have a new client. They work with like 400 universities. They're $1.5 billion company. And I end up at dinner with their chief research officer. So it's me and him across. He's across the table. And we sit down, and he's got all the great, he's got all the fancy institutional name, fancy credentials. So PhD, Harvard, Yale, really, really successful business guy. who's the lead researcher at a research organization. And he just, first thing he says, Luke, okay, so why haven't you built a tool to help an individual like my brother who doesn't know what he's doing in life to take all of his past experience, all of his skills, who he is, and then use your algorithms and technology to match that with employers who need that kind of thing, and then match that with an educational opportunity that makes the gap, makes up the gap between him here and that little Lego of difference, that discrete unit of difference, so that he can then move into a more, a higher paying job. Like, can't you do that? You got all the data, right? It's like, I said, no, we can't do it. I said, why, Luke? I said, well, the world doesn't work that way. What do you mean? It's like, well, for one, the employer signals that you want me to use are garbage. Oh, yeah, you're right. It's like, so you want me to, let's say he needs a skill of team building, which people need these days. So if you guys, if there's anything you do at NSA, work on your team building. And one activity you might try is doing the dishes together in the commons. So team building. And he's like, well, what about these skills? Like I said, and I just said, sir, team building where? At what company? What is team building? It's like, team building is different at your company. It's different at other, like at this company in this region. It's very, very different. And he's like, oh, you're right. Man, it's like, this is a bad idea. Well, what about my brother-in-law? Can't you help him? It's like, well, you want me to describe him. You want me to describe him as 3 jobs, 5 skills, and a degree. Do you think that's sufficient? Do you feel like described by that? Or even if you could maybe see yourself in that description, do you think that's accurate, maybe a really accurate template or starting point for what you could be doing that would be more fulfilling? It's like, no. And he sort of reached a point of, well, what do we do, Luke? And I said, well, algorithms are great. All this data technology is great, but you can't ignore. It needs to be used in conjunction with something else. So the metaphor I used with him was, the great thing about eHarmony is that it doesn't just marry you. Get it? That was really funny, guys. You're supposed to. So what eHarmony does is takes all this information about you from your profile, from the information you've given it, and using algorithms, matches you up with someone else. Great, but what's missing? Like that happens, but then fortunately, you go on a date. You actually experience each other, right? It's like, oh man, yes, you're exactly right. So technology, these empirical techniques, using technology can be really effective spotting patterns and making humans better at what humans do really well. And in particular, equipping individuals to connect more effectively so that they can experience each other and know each other personally. So that conversation's truncated down, and it was a 3-hour conversation, I've truncated it down for you. But we're walking back, actually, after that comment, he said, why isn't your company twice the size, Luke? I said, well, we're in Idaho. So he was super, it was funny, he was super excited. On the way back, someone was walking with him and told him that I went to a liberal arts college, and I was walking down the streets of DC, and he went, liberal arts? What? And I turned around, it's like, you're a liberal arts guy? And I went, sir, we just had a 3-hour epistemological conversation. This is about the nature of what you can and cannot know. Of course I'm a liberal arts guy. And he was just flabbergasted. It's like, I am too. It's like, welcome back. So what do you guys take from that and from what I've said so far? I've got some exhortations application for you, but in particular related to that conversation, this is your father's world, NSA students. You're learning that Christ is the integration point of all things. Don't be afraid of the scientists or the data people or the technology people. They have a very skewed view of the world, and in particular, many of them are trying to control the world. They're trying to build certainty into the world in ways that will never work. So the idea that he had of like, okay, well, if we can just describe an individual as these discrete units of skills and competencies and experience, and use an algorithm to match them to a company's depiction of what they think they need, we got it, right? It's like, no, because there's all these other phenomena called real people that get in the way of that. Companies today, there's a huge hubris and desire to use technology to control the world and to build certainty into the world. Here's two materially different domains. It's a materially different thing to understand how to place someone in a job using algorithms than how to get an Uber to an address. The physical world is great for all this information technology and for all the empirical work and data work that's going on. You know, like things fall at a consistent rate. Like the physical world is pretty ripe for technological advancement. And many of the services that have really, really made a dent relate back to that reality. Like if you think about Uber is effectively a chauffeur for you. They've disintermediated an information problem. They're getting a ride to you and it works really wonderfully. Amazon is basically a massive logistics business. They're moving stuff. It's old industries. I mean, as old as old. And they're just using technology to make them more effective. It's not new stuff, right? Where the technology work that people really want to push, it relates to people and how they interact and economies, domains where those techniques really don't work in. And that's one of the challenges for me at MZ is that's where we exist, right? We exist in a world where we're trying to understand how to use data to predict and help people make better decisions about their own interactions, which is a whole lot messier world. I said earlier that this is your father's world, right? So you can have the confidence to go out into this world as a teacher, as a pastor, as an entrepreneur, and build toward the world you know God made, toward his personality, and trust that will be a successful move. Does that make sense? Don't go into technology. Most of the technology entrepreneurs we hear of today are trying to build a future that just doesn't scan with who God is. So if you're gonna go work in those fields, please remember, this is your father's kingdom. It's his world. Okay. Let me go through my exhortations quickly, and then we'll go on to questions. The first is simply the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Obey. Do what God's put in front of you and do it faithfully. That's it. What's your calling in life? Well, your calling is primarily to do what God has put in front of you. It's okay to not know what's next. The second one is be confidently uncertain. And I'm gonna read a Chesterton quote that I'm sure you've heard and then tweak it. What we suffer from today is humility in the wrong place. Modesty's moved from the organ of ambition and settled upon the organ of conviction, where it was never meant to be. A man was meant to be doubtful about himself, but undoubting about the truth. This has been exactly reversed. We're on the road to producing a race of men too mentally modest to believe in the multiplication table. Humility about what we can know, but not about our own convictions. And there's a way in which today, man is working really hard to have total certainty, trying to find total certainty about the world, what the next step is, how to predict and control the world. Right? But what you as Christians going out into the workforce, out from here, need to have, I would argue, is a confident uncertainty. Be confident in your Heavenly Father, that he's working all things for your good, and be comfortable being uncertain about your future path, because you're never going to be able to figure it out. The last thing I want to say is just a different perspective for you guys. One of the things that was really hard for me at NSA was poetry. Anybody else? Can I get a raise of hands? You're not a poet and you know it, right? That's my favorite. And one of the, you know, we talk about poetry, I think Samuel Johnson talked about invention, the idea of poetry and invention. And I think it's an apt metaphor. If you remember in one of the articles I read, he talked about how most, his perspective was that technology, that innovation was primarily driven by technology and science and engineering. Right? I think that's not really true, especially as the world, as technology gets to some extent more effective, the people who will be really innovative are ones who see the humanity of the world, who can see the world in new ways, and also in ways that are right in front of most people, and you just can't see it. One example I'll use just to illustrate that is the suitcase. I don't know if you guys know this, but for a long time, suitcases didn't have wheels. People actually hauled them around airports. There were a lot of really well-credentialed academics and fancy pants people, it's a term I like to use if you haven't noticed, studying innovation, carrying around a suitcase full of heavy books. And someone, probably not someone who was in a specialized field of luggage and luggage innovation, thought, hey, why aren't there wheels on this thing? And you know the beauty of really great poetry is when something that you have seen so many times, you're able to see anew because of another person who's used things that already exist, words, metaphors, etc., to open your eyes to them. That's invention in the world, and it's not just literary. So my exhortation to you guys is open your eyes to opportunities to invent businesses, communities, literature, whatever it may be, out of the things of the world by seeing it anew and putting them together in fresh ways. Nassim Taleb said really, really aptly that true innovation never comes out of the main corpus of an industry or group. So it's almost impossible to really innovate if you're stuck in the main body of thought. So you have to actually be outside of it. The cool thing for you guys, you may not have noticed, you're outside of it. So go kick some butt. I think I've used up all my time.
All right, thanks, Luke. That was great.
Sorry.
That's my poetry. I'm not good at rapping. So we've got a little bit of time here for us to ask you some questions, and then I'm going to open it up to the audience. But I just want to kick it off with one of the things you mentioned was, I think you said, don't try to defend your liberal arts degree.
Yeah.
Right. Especially with soft skills like we're used to hearing it defended. But we've all been in that situation when you go home for Christmas break and you've got that one uncle who you only see at Christmas, and he asks you, what the heck are you doing at a liberal arts school? And so if you're not defending it, what do you do in that situation?
Well, I'd raise the bar for you and say, have at the ready things you are doing as a person that you can change the subject toward. I don't know, you're like a business guy, right? I think I know that about you.
Yeah, basically.
So what are you doing in that area?
Financial advising, learning about business, stuff like that.
Yeah, so, well, why are you at a liberal arts college? It's like, why is that? In some ways, you need to flip it and make it be about how you're being shaped, who you are, and how the education is equipping you to be more effective at the financial stuff that he might care about.
Cool.
That's my recommendation is don't find yourself being like, well, Herodotus is really, really helpful sometimes on Facebook. It's not gonna get you. Sorry, Dr. Schlecht, most of the time on Facebook, it's really helpful.
All right. That makes sense, thanks.
Also, did you guys notice Gabe's shirt today? It's just him.
So I have a practical question for job interviews for NSA students. So let's say an NSA student is in an engineering firm or an accounting firm, and they're interviewing for a position, and the hiring manager says, well, I see you don't have the correct degree, and you're about to get passed over. What's the best response to that? How can you sell yourself without saying, well, excuse me, ma'am, you have it all wrong.
Right.
I don't need a degree.
If you weren't such a, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, this is where, when I said, like, take responsibility, you got to recognize that the employers are going to look for certain signals. They're lazy. And if you don't have that signal, you're going to have to bring something else to the table. And it's more work, but it's work that you have to do. So if you're going to go to an interview at an engineering firm with no work experience, done projects, additional education than MZ, well, I don't think you've taken enough responsibility.
So you mentioned...
Right back at you. Sorry.
So you mentioned that neither hard skills nor soft skills on their own are going to be enough. And you've kind of seen how in recent years the demand for people who have soft skills has gone way up. But is it possible, do you foresee that the pendulum could swing the opposite way in another decade? And say you have a glut of soft-skilled people wanting to be hired and not enough people with hard skills that employers need?
Probably, because both employers and job seekers they're going to continue, I think, unless some structural things get fixed, they're going to continue to signal really poorly about what they actually need. One of the problems with the soft skill, hard skill conversation as it works out in the labor market is employers are trying to describe what they need in a worker with really ineffective or incapable descriptions. And that's in part the fruit of some of the digitization of hiring. Employers want to be able to make hiring a really efficient process. So they want to, in order to do that, they want to be able to scalably describe, this is what we need. The best employers don't do that. They know that there's this personal component that we need to see, we need to know the person, we need to have them come in for an interview, they need to do a project. There's all of these things that they need to do to really verify that that person will be a good fit. The bad employers just want a computer to do the matching for them. So as long as that bad set of signal interactions going on, sure, it's gonna swing back and forth. My argument is ignore it. Ignore it. Everyone in this room has certain gifts and capabilities, and some of you could go be computer scientists, some of you can't, and that's okay. Take responsibility for finding out what God has really called you to through experience and pursue that. One of the things I thought that I didn't put in here was, especially right after college, I encourage you guys to pursue finding out what you're not called for. Like, really, like, go try things and fail at them miserably. Because that information is going to be way more helpful for you than trying to exactly define what you think you're called to. Because that's a bit of an impossible task anyway. It's the good old via negativa, the negative way. It's easier to know the things you're not supposed to do than necessarily what you're supposed to do. So go figure out what you're not called to. If you think, man, technology would be awesome, go try and code, and you might find out the reason you got bad grades in Latin is you struggle with language, and that carries over to Python, just saying. Is that helpful? I'm just saying, like, don't get sucked in to that part of the conversation, because it's not working. Like that, the current hiring system works really, really poorly because of the ways it tries to define people. It's just fundamentally the thing. And one of the things I'm excited about in terms of MZ's potential is bringing a view of people to bear on the question that reflects more how God made us. And I'm happy to bet on that, even if it sounds crazy to people in San Francisco, because God made the world.
So I guess I kind of just want to not necessarily push against that, but push that further. And with Colin's question about how do you handle an interviewee who your challenge kind of like, you don't have this degree, what makes you qualified? Well, push it back a step. I think that lots of us really do believe that we're capable of doing whatever job we need to do, but we need the chance to prove ourselves. We're ready to prove ourselves, and we're eager, and we're excited, and we're convinced that we have the capabilities, and I think we can convince an employer of that as well. But sometimes we don't even get to that step because, you know, you mentioned they want an employee that fits an algorithm. They want you to apply online. Things have become so depersonalized, so you're competing against tens of thousands of other graduates, and you're being filtered through a system that's doesn't even give you the chance to prove yourself. So how would you suggest that we as NSA grads approach that? Because as much as we'd like to maybe avoid employers who are going to try to just fit a module,
profile you,
we can't really avoid that unless we have maybe personal connections or kind of a unique opportunity where people are more familiar with our school. So how do you suggest that we make ourselves appealing on paper to get to the point where we can actually prove ourselves?
My initial reaction is just to say, start your own thing. There's a talk on Wednesday about entrepreneurship, and I know that sound. I mean, that's a little might sound trite, but if you have an opportunity to start a business, to make something, to have equity in something, take it. Take that opportunity. There's a way in which a job, a job at a major corporation, is a form of servitude and slavery. Look, I went and I got all my paperwork. I got these degrees. Here you go. What do you get back? You expect, many students expect to get back, you know, three square meals, enough money for their car, their iPhone, their tech, and a vacation every year. You can't have a slave-servant mindset. And I hope you won't. So that's part of the problem with the system today with some of these companies is they kind of imply that. And there's only so much work you could do to get around it. So if you don't have clear opportunities because of those challenges, what's keeping you from starting something? Be a leader. Be a builder. Is that... Please.
Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, I don't want you to like under, I know that's a big deal because you're just out of college and got all this stuff happening and you need a job to pay bills. It's like, it's like, well, frankly, that never stops happening. It's better to do that when it's just you than when you have seven kids. Just saying.
So in other words, if you have a business idea, you're happy to invest, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, totally. here's the thing about people is that wherever you go, there you are. And this is for you guys as students. You're not going to become great employees or great business owners if you can't motivate yourself and take responsibility for your work today. That's not just going to change. So my biggest encouragement, I guess, to you then for now, for your current students, is get your work done, work hard, take initiative, and be faithful here and now. And God will open up more opportunities for you.
All right, so we've got a couple minutes for some questions from the audience.
Yeah, cool.
So,
or if you want to beatbox, that'd be cool too.
Got lots of people right up here.
I was just wondering if you would suggest, in addition to a liberal arts degree, if we were interested in pursuing, say, something like a STEM education as well, if that would be kind of recommended course in addition to a liberal arts degree as to what those skills would entail?
Yeah, yes and no. It really depends on you. You know, one of my colleagues, good friend, Justin Ware, his brother's here, I think, doesn't have a STEM degree, really phenomenal developer, brilliant guy. He was coding making money as a coder when he was 16. It's like some of this is baked in. Like if you're not interested in coding and things like that and working on it, it's not something you just turn on, if that makes sense. So there's no, like, I think you should be thoughtful about what you are interested in and where you've shown capability and gifting and pursue those as areas to add to your education and find actual work experiences where you can test that. Not just, the part of the fallacy is like everyone is the same person going into every field. It's like, and the degree is the difference, and it's just not the case. I had a room I was actually, I'll be honest, less nervous for was 22 university presidents of Texas. I presented to them a couple years ago in Austin. And before the meeting, I was talking to the chancellor of the University of Texas system, and he said, it's like, well, Luke, the problem isn't that students don't know that people with engineering degrees get great jobs. It's that engineering's hard, right? There's a way which there's only so many people with the gifting to do that kind of work. So find your gifting, ask about it, get feedback on it, but try through experience to pursue, to figure out what you're not called for. I already said that. I'll stop. Go ahead. Next person.
So you said that it doesn't necessarily matter what degree you have in the first place, but how much would you say of an advantage is it to have any degree at all?
Oh, that's hands down. I mean, all the statistics show the bachelor's degree is a signal to employers that you're a certain kind of person. It's the primary role it plays, I think. It plays a role as a signal. You're someone who went through 4 years of education. You probably learned how to write something. You probably can show up on time. I don't know, that's less and less the case. That's one of the key skills people are actually looking for, is like showing up. Way to go, millennials. Don't ruin it for all of us. Finish your degree. I think that is definitely an important thing to do. Is that helpful? Part of the problem, though, just to be frank, part of the problem with that is, again, employers are lazy. They're looking for a variable, a causal variable, to sort of paint everybody with, and it's just a filtering device. So if you don't have a bachelor's degree and you apply online with a resume, you're likely to not get a call back just because you don't have a bachelor's degree, which is really frustrating when companies complain about not having the skills they need. It's like, well, you're just ignoring so many of the people because I won't get into the problems about the digitization and automation of the HR world, but if you'd like to afterwards, I can.
So my question is, what would you suggest would be a good way to actually get away from the degree question? What kinds of things are employers, what skills are employers looking for that you can actually focus on those things and sell yourself on those things? And if they ask about your education, great, you know, then you can think of answers to those. But how can you kind of separate yourself, make yourself stand out away from your degree?
Pursue the employer. And there's a whole set of ways you can do that. Even at EMSI, we have an application process for like developers where you have to complete a project. So if you're trying to go into or apply for a job that you don't have experience in, or you're not credentialed in, show some work product that demonstrates that you can do it, and then pursue them. Be that pest. Get around their digital system for trying to filter you. I worked in sales for years, and man, sales is about persistence and just continuing to push and taking responsibility for getting someone's attention. And I think that's really important for you guys to think about when you go into settings where you are sort of already predisposed to not be considered. You're gonna have to work harder to get attention. Recognize that, take responsibility for it, be creative, show who you are. Like, don't be, you know, I submitted an application, but I don't have the right degree. Shoot. Well, why did you waste your time? Like, there's either something that you're better fit for, where your credential, your degree will be recognized as a good signal for, or do something that will help you to stand out. You can still stand out today, even if you're not tall like me.
All right, well, that is, okay, one more question. Let's make it a good one, and then we'll close it.
I'll try and make the answer good as well.
So a common sentiment among the students at NSA is to not care about grades, which doesn't necessarily mean that at the cost of excellence, but to not make grades like your priority. How do you synthesize that with your exhortation to be faithful as students?
Well, did the teachers stop caring about the grades? Sorry, that was, couldn't resist that one. Well, I'll use myself as an example. So you heard, when I graduated, I had two kids. My wife and I had started a business, and I was working almost full time to support my family. My grades, as people in this room will likely tell you, were not the point at that time. It's like, I was really, honestly, like, there was one Greek final that I went into having done none of the homework, and it wasn't unfaithful of me. I was working to feed my family. I mean, I got an SCL on the final, but that was a different story. don't do that. It was God's kindness and it was luck, I would say too. So everyone's situation's different. Honestly, if you're here as a student and you don't have greater responsibilities and you're not working your tail off to be excellent, then drop out. Go do something else.
All right, on that encouraging note, we'll go ahead. Let's give Luke another round of applause. And
I'm a 2009 graduate of New St. Andrews College, and I'm a commercial property manager.
Three kids at Logos, one at home still, and I do flowers on the side out of our house. When you have these little people that you're responsible to shepherd, you realize, I need to know what I'm talking about, because they need to have a firm foundation and they need deep roots so that they don't get blown over and that they're ready to stand up for the truth.
I am a programmer. The language aspect of NSA is a fantastic preparation for any sort of programming.
I'm a real estate broker here in town. I think absolutely the perfect education for being in sales of really any kind.
I actually put it to a lot of great use when I was working in the political realm.
I am a pastor in Central Coast, California. Whatever vocation you take, it'll make you take that seriously because you're seeing it through the lens of the sovereignty and lordship of Christ.
To learn more, visit us online at nsa.edu.